Thank you, Mary. That doesn't mean everyone should go to sleep. So, welcome everyone to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Rachel Long. I am a longtime member of Prairie, and I get to preside today. Prairie aspires to be an open-hearted and open-minded congregation, and we welcome everyone, no matter what your ethnic or religious background, your sexual orientation or family structure, your place of residence, your abilities or inabilities. We try to be welcoming to everyone. A little bit later in the service, if you are a visitor or returning friend, you'll have the opportunity to introduce yourself so we might get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we have a wide variety of services, so if this is your first or second time, we encourage you to return again in the future and try us out, because it's a little bit different each week. Sometimes our services are presented by a Prairie member, sometimes someone from the wider community, and sometimes by our consulting minister, Sandy Ingham. Today we have one of our own, Ann Urbanski, is going to be presenting to us. We have no announcements today. Other than those that are already in your order of service and on the both on the announcements next to and also on the calendar on the back. And I really, really appreciate it that everyone got their announcements in on time to be printed in the order of service so that we don't have to spend our time doing that today. Our opening words today will be read by Karen Deaton.
The principle of the inherent worth and dignity of every person is not about who deserves worth and dignity. It isn't about anyone else, it's about me. It's about a choice that I make every day and how I choose to treat others. We can treat a person with respect and dignity while questioning, challenging, or even confronting their behavior. Yes, doing so is difficult. I think our UU faith is about calling us to our better selves, and I don't think that's supposed to be easy. That's by John Cooper.
Now please join me in singing our first hymn, Gather the Spirit, which Eileen will accompany. It's number 347, and stand as you are able.
Thank you.
We have an unusual situation this morning where we actually had multiple volunteers for our readings. So if you don't get called and you thought you were reading, don't feel too surprised. Today, for our chalice lighting, we'll have Bob and Barb Park.
We light this chalice to celebrate the inherent worth and dignity of every person, to reaffirm the historic pledge of liberal religion, to seek that justice which transcends mere legality and moves towards the resolution of true equality, and to share that love which is ultimately beyond even our cherished reason, that love which unites us. Stephen Stock.
And now I invite any children or adults who feel like they want to join the children to come up to the front for a story for all ages, which will be read by Penny Iyer.
We're reading from Bedtime for Buddha again today. And remember the last time I did this for you? We prepared ourselves to hear the story, so let's try it again today. Everybody can do that. Okay, so you raise your arms in the air and breathe in real deep.
Oops, sorry.
And let it out slow. Well, that was pretty good, but let's try it one more time. Raise your arms and breathe in. Oh, great. Is everybody in a story mood now? Terrific. Whoops, I lost my page. Oh, here we go. We're going to talk about the lion and the jackal. Yeah. Relax and be still and listen. Listen carefully to this tale about a mighty lion who lived on a vast, grassy plain. Although he was a kind lion, most of the animals feared him, and he did not have many friends. But that was to change that day when the lion found himself in trouble. Do you want to know what happened? Listen and see if we can find out. Now, on this particular day, the lion set off to explore the far side of the plain. And after some time, he began to feel thirsty, kind of like walking around out there today. So he went down to the Great Lake to get a drink. And he waded in a little way and lapped up some cool, refreshing water. Tasted good. But as he tried to return to the water's edge, he felt himself slowly sinking into the mud. He tried to pull himself free. But the more he struggled, the more he stuck fast. He looked up to the sun for help. But the sun was taking a rest from shining behind some thick, dark clouds. The lion was still stuck. When the nighttime came and the moon climbed in the dark sky, he called to the moon for help, but she was too busy chatting to a star to hear him. Soon he began to give up hope that he would ever be rescued. Just then, a little jackal came along, singing to himself. "Goodness, a lion!" he exclaimed. Terrified, the jackal was about to jump for cover in the undergrowth when the lion called out to him, "Help me, please, Mr. Jackal, help me. I'm completely stuck in the mud." "The king of the jungle wants me help from me?" thought the jackal in amazement. Turning to the lion, he said, "But if I free you, you'll just gobble me up." "I won't, I promise. I'm a lion of my word." "Please, don't be afraid," said the lion. "If you help free me, I'll be your friend forever." The jackal was a kind soul who didn't like to see anyone suffer. So he gathered all his courage and he approached the lion. With a little huffing and puffing and scrabbling around, he dug the mutton from around the lion's great paws.
Is there a picture?
No, just the one. There he is, there, stuck in the mud. And there's the little jackal. He looks like a little dog, doesn't he? Yeah, yeah. Anyhow, the lion tried really hard to pull his paws free, and one by one, he managed to lift them out of the mud. Then he scrambled up the bank, shook his great mane, and threw back his head and roared, "I'm free!" "And it's all thanks to you, my friend. It's late and dark, and I live far from here. Would you help me once again by letting me stay in your home tonight?" he asked. Started the jackal reluctantly. "Of course, I give you my word that I won't harm you or your family," interrupted the lion, who could see that his new friend was worried. "Well, if you promise, I suppose, yes, you're welcome to come. But my home is small and plain," replied the jackal, who decided that he could trust the lion. Off they went to the jackal's home. Mrs. Jackal was very startled to see the lion, and the little jackal pups were frightened that they ran behind their mother's back. "Don't worry, my dears. The lion is my friend," said the jackal proudly, and he explained how he had rescued him from the mud. Mrs. Jackal was still rather suspicious, but the lion said, "Tonight you did me a great service, my friend, and as king of the jungle, I would like to repay you for all your kindness by taking care of you and your family from now on. I would like you to come and live with me and my family in our luxurious royal den." Oh, fancy schmancy. After some discussion, the jackals agreed, and so the next morning they set off for the lion's den. The families lived happily together, and as time went by, the lion and the jackal became the best of friends. However, the lioness gradually began to resent their friendship, fearing that the lion loved the jackal family more than his own. It started as a small thought, but the more she dwelt on it, the more the seed of jealousy grew in her heart until it taken over all her thoughts. One day she decided they had to go. Okay. From then on, whenever she was alone with Mrs. Jackal, the lioness would find fault with her or criticize the little jackal pups. At first, Mrs. Jackal ignored the lioness's unkind ways, but eventually, after a particularly horrible day, Mrs. Jackal said to her husband, "I fear we are no longer welcome here. Mrs. Lion complains about everything I do. The lion must want us to leave." Now, the jackal didn't believe that the lion would break his promise, so he went straight to him and said, "My friend, perhaps we have outstayed our welcome in your home. Your wife no longer seems to want us here. Would you like us to leave?" Surprised, the lion asked his wife, "My dear, is this true? Do you want our friends to go?" Mrs. Lion looked up sadly and replied, "I'm sorry, but these days you seem to put the jackal before your own, family before your own. You don't appear to care much about us anymore." "My darling wife," replied the lion, "let me assure you that my love for you and our cubs is in no way lessened by my love for our friends. When the jackal saved my life, I became forever in his debt. So I offered him and his family my protection. Caring for them only enriches my love for you and our cubs." Hearing this, the lion felt very ashamed of her jealousy. She apologized again and again to the jackal family. And after that day, she became firm friends with the lovely Mrs. Jackal. From then on, the two families spent the rest of their days enjoying each other's company without further resentment or arguments, and their descendants lived happily together for generations to come. And the Buddha says, "Sometimes it's easy to let fear and jealousy cloud our judgment, but the wise person knows that there is enough love in their heart to give to every living creature in the world."
Thank you.
Farewell, farewell, till we meet again.
As a caring community, we now take time to briefly share any joys, sorrows, or concerns with our Prairie community. Please wait for the microphone to share so everyone can hear, and Mary has the microphones today.
I want to share my joy with the Music Madison we had here at Prairie. I was sorry that we had another engagement and couldn't stay for the whole thing, but Mary represented Prairie so well, and we owe her thanks for that.
Well, I have a new grandchild. Tanner Joseph was born on June 15th in Denver. And that is my joy. And my sorrow is his father is difficult to deal with. So I'm glad to be home.
Well, I'm back from Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I went to my little cousin Tavery's middle school graduation. I don't know when middle school got to be, graduating from middle school got to be a big deal. But it was augmented by the fact that Casey flew in from Alaska because she had a friend from England visiting in New Hampshire. So she got to go to the graduation and then spent time in New Hampshire with her British friend, who was very upset about the Brexit. And I also got to see Orange and Dean's daughter, Katrina, and her future husband. So it was a terrific trip all the way around.
Ron is a happy boy today because he is in Elkhart Lake watching Indy-style Formula One racing. And he was a happy boy yesterday, like all the rest of us attending the Canadian party. It was a riot.
This coming Tuesday, I have my 20-week ultrasound, and so we're just hoping that the baby has all the parts it needs. We're not finding out the sex of the baby.
Awesome.
That is a surprise. We're hoping the baby has everything else it needs.
At the end of last month, our daughter Kate graduated from UW-Madison with her PhD in animal chemistry. And at the beginning of this month, she started her postdoc at Yale University in New Haven.
Oh my God. That's so exciting.
And it's also a joy to be back from our trip to Brazil, which I can describe to folks if they want to know more about it.
As some of you might know, our dog, a corgi, Bix, was euthanized on June 20th. And he was 84 people years, so he lived a good life. And he was a pal, and I always knew what he was thinking. He was amazing, and we miss him.
Well, the middle of July, I'll be going to West Virginia for my 50th high school reunion.
Oh,
pretty old. And then also, about the same time, my brother will be having open heart surgery to repair a valve. So I'll be his buddy.
Light one last candle for any sorrows, joys, or concerns that are unexpressed. And now we have a moment of silent meditation. Please join me for our next hymn, Love Makes a Bridge, and that's number 325 in your hymnal, and stand as you are able. our presentation today, which is entitled Fear is the Path to the Dark Side, the Inherent Worth and Dignity of Every Person versus Fear of the Other, is presented by Ann Urbanski, who is a longtime member here at Prairie, also secretary of our board, a longtime, or at least 5 years, right, member of PFLAG, which is an organization that supports and advocates and educates regarding LGBT issues, but that's just one fragment of our talk today. So I was telling Ann this morning how timely I thought this topic was this week. Please welcome Ann Urbanski.
Good morning. Sorry, I gotta open my thing here. I'm one of these people who has to have a script. So I wrote a sermon, and here goes. Okay. We, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. The very first words of our denomination's principles make it plain that Unitarian Universalism is an aspirational religious movement. Our first principle commits us as individuals within this movement to look for the good in every person and, as much as possible, to follow the golden rule in our relationships with family, friends, and strangers, even those who disagree with us on religious, political, or social issues. According to UU minister and theologian Reverend Rebecca Ann Parker, and this is a quote, "Reverence and respect for human nature is at the core of UU faith. We believe that all the dimensions of our being carry the potential to do good. We celebrate the gifts of being human, our intelligence and capacity for observation and reason, our senses and ability to appreciate beauty, our creativity and our creativity, our feelings and emotions. We cherish our bodies as well as our souls. We can use our gifts to offer love, to work for justice, to heal injury, to create pleasure for ourselves and others. The great 20th century rabbi Abraham Heschel wrote, "Just to be is a blessing. Just to live is holy." Unitarian Universalists affirm the inherent worth and dignity of each person as a given of faith, an unshakable conviction calling us to self-respect and respect for others. That's the end of the quote. This is not a creedal statement. Unitarian Universalism has no creeds, no dogma to be memorized and recited on demand. Instead, we have principles that ideally we internalize and live out in our daily lives. To UU's, religion is not only about going to church on Sunday. It's about doing and being. This is the aspirational aspect I spoke of. We aspire to be our best selves, and much of that involves doing unto others as we would have them do unto us. Our aspirational movement is also idealistic. The seven principles do not describe the current state of society, but rather seem to represent goals to work toward in our relationships with our families, our communities, and within our nation. To me, they are the desired state we could achieve with a lot of work, not just from UUs, but from other like-minded people. Some might even say they are utopian. When times are good and things seem to be going well for us, why shouldn't we treat others with respect and dignity? For those of us who are living decently balanced lives and whose past hasn't been shaped by serious traumas, treating others with respect and decency ought to be the simplest path. And yet, as we know, many people relate to the world in a perpetual state of fear. And being fearful of the other, of the ones who are not like me, makes it difficult to see another person's inherent worth and dignity. As the great science fiction philosopher Yoda, and I won't try to do his voice, said in Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, "Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering." And Gary Gates will do our first reading. Yes. Yeah, you can come up here.
Human beings are capable of just about any good and any evil. At some level, we are neither inherently good nor inherently evil, but have great capacity for both. All babies are born good. We're seemingly born that way, but they will develop the capacity for evil. Some of them, some of us, will act out that capacity. Some will not. A few will commit great atrocities. Most will not. Some of us will suffer greatly. Some of us will see that suffering and simply pass by. In the end, we are simply looking into a mirror. We are all made of the same stuff. No matter how great our flaws, there is always also contained within every human the very essence of our humanity, our inherent worth and dignity, which gives us our capacity to give and receive love. It is that capacity that finally reconciles all people in the end to the wholeness and to the source of all love. Reverend Beth Ellen Cooper.
Excuse me. In recent years, probably since September 11th, I've thought a lot about the role that fear now plays in American society. Perhaps this is why for the past 6 or 8 years I've been really fascinated by dystopian fiction, whether in books, movies, or especially television. I recently realized that most of the books and TV series I've been invested in the last few years have focused on post-apocalyptic dystopian scenarios. Some, but not all of these, include the Hunger Games books and films, which take place some years after an unspecified apocalypse, probably in the late 21st or early 22nd century. The Walking Dead and its companion show, Fear the Walking Dead, wherein ordinary people attempt to survive a zombie apocalypse and each other. The Last Ship, which takes place during a worldwide viral apocalypse, and Falling Skies, which a show that ended last year, which was set during an alien invasion, aka alien apocalypse. Most recently, my husband and I have been, I have to say, this is one of the things that my husband and I share, is this love for this kind of stuff. So, most recently, my husband and I have been watching a show on Netflix called Jericho, which lasted only 2 seasons on network television about 10 years ago. Jericho is a fictional small town in far northwestern Kansas near the Colorado state line. The main character, Jake Green, returns to his hometown after a 5-year absence. Jake, a 30-something, is apparently the black sheep of his family, and he recounts to his parents, younger brother, and friends varied stories about where he had been. He leaves after a disagreement with his father, but while he is driving along the highway, a nuclear bomb explodes just across the state line in Denver. In the aftermath, Jake encounters a crashed bus and its occupants. He saves the injured bus driver and a group of young children. A prison bus also crashes, allowing the convicts inside to escape and kill the sheriff of Jericho. The town's citizens grow more worried when they learn of a second nuclear explosion in Atlanta. In several months following the nuclear blasts, and this is a small, average, ordinary kind of a farming town out in the middle of nowhere in Kansas, the residents of Jericho have to deal with numerous things they've not experienced before. Radioactive fallout arrives on the wind and in a rainstorm, forcing residents to hide in basements and other shelters. One stranger is later found in the pharmacy dying of radiation poisoning and burns, which of course scares the people who find him. Gasoline starts to run low and is rationed for primary use by the town's small medical center. The electric grid becomes unstable, causing a power spike that starts a major fire. The U.S. government, or what they believe is left of it, believing that the bombs to be the work of a foreign power, launches intercontinental ballistic missiles from a nearby Air Force base, and an electric pulse from the ICBMs fries all the electronic devices in the town. So the town is now effectively cut off from the outside world, has no stable electrical supply, and is running low on fuel and food. Electricity eventually becomes unavailable as there's no longer enough fuel to run the generators except at the medical center. Homes and businesses are lit by candlelight. The local grocery store runs low on goods, and people begin to barter with the store owner for food. But some people aren't satisfied with bartering, and the grocer is eventually murdered by a local thief. The local doctor has to barter with a different thief for medicine to treat the mayor's illness. The employees of a private security firm called Ravenwood, which I think is kind of Blackwater, confront some townspeople with a demand that they hand over their supplies to Ravenwood for use by the U.S. government. An armed group of Jericho residents makes a stand and blows up one of the bridges into the town to prevent Ravenwood goons from entering. A man suspected of murdering the grocer is caught. Jake's father has been the mayor for 25 years, but he loses his bid for re-election, and the new mayor wants to basically summarily execute the murder suspect without a trial. But under pressure from Jake's father, he decides to exile the man instead. A group of several dozen refugees arrives in town after walking more than 150 miles from Wichita, where their plane had made an emergency landing the day of the blasts. Jake and others in the town argue in favor of taking them in, despite the strain it will place on people already struggling to deal with food rationing. Lack of electricity and gasoline and so forth. And this is just the first half of season one. So these people are going through a lot. All right. By the end of the season, a neighboring town is threatening to take over most of Jericho's farmland, food, and other supplies by force, resulting in a pitched battle outside of Jericho with Jake playing a leading role. What I like about this show is that the reactions of Jericho's residents seem to run the gamut of how ordinary people might react when faced with such an extraordinary and extraordinarily stressful situation. Some, like Jake, are able to rise to the challenge, perhaps because they are basically decent people who are able to see the humanity in others, even people they've never met. Others, like the new mayor, find the situation more than they can handle. Later in the season, he is not only paranoid about all newcomers, but also unable to make important decisions. Worst to me are the Ravenwood thugs who steal and harm people for business reasons. It's just business. And the leaders of the nearby town who see everybody outside their immediate group as an existential threat. In life as in fiction, crises seem to bring out the best in some people and the worst in others. It seems to me that those who are led by their fear of the other, people who are not like us or not from here, have the most trouble with difficult times and uncertainty. They are the people I worry will end up on the path to the dark side, which seems to be easy to slide toward if you're not making a conscious effort to see and value the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Just a few days ago, we saw the United Kingdom possibly take a step toward the dark side with its vote to leave the European Union. A demographic breakdown of the Brexit vote shows that most of the people who voted in favor of leaving the EU were more than 45 years old and lived in England and Wales. Some news analyses suggested that many of the leave voters were motivated by a dislike or fear of immigrants and refugees. On a radio show I listen to regularly, one of the hosts mentioned an exit polling interview with an elderly woman who voted to leave the EU. "Well, I just don't like the Negroes," she said matter-of-factly. And I saw another little clip on TV the other day. It was an elderly man sitting in a barber shop, and he said, "The immigrants and the refugees, get rid of all of them. Make them go." And now Kathy Converse will do our second reading.
To make our first principle into a spiritual practice requires us to honestly acknowledge that we have been programmed by our society to treasure and cherish certain kinds of people over others, and to see only a select few as bearing as much worth, value, and dignity as we ourselves have. The rest we have been trained by many forces to regard as other. We're either afraid of that other, or feel superior to that other, or almost as bad, we've learned to feel a kind of privilege, pity, or charity toward those others. And please God, spare us from that latter perhaps most of all. It's not enough for Unitarian Universalism or any other religious tradition to simply try to have the right virtuous thoughts and feelings. Something more is asked of us, and the name for that something more is love. That enormous, demanding, divine idea that asks us not only to feel virtuous things, but to shape our actions around those feelings. Reverend Victoria Weinstein.
As John Cooper stated in today's opening words, it's not up to us to decide who deserves worth and dignity. Each of us, every day, has to make a choice about how we treat other people, even those who are vastly different from us. One of the hardest things for me, for example, is remembering that a certain candidate for leader of the free world has inherent worth and dignity somewhere, no matter what heinous things that person says or does. I can call him on those words and actions without using language that degrades that person as a human being. And that's hard, and I have failed at that numerous times, and I admit it. I also have trouble remembering that some members of our Congress have inherent worth and dignity, even though, through their words and their votes, they often behave as though they don't respect the inherent worth and dignity of certain other people in our country. For example, people who are poor, or disabled, or in the LGBT community. This also applies to certain preachers whose words make me want to tear my hair out and throw things at them. Fortunately, physical distance, my desire not to get arrested, and my belief in the first principle keep me from acting on those impulses. Hardest of all, to me at least, is remembering that somewhere deep in their souls, mass murderers and serial killers had some shred of worth and dignity. Maybe it was only there when they were small children, and somehow it got stomped smaller than a pinhead. I will not mention the Orlando shooter's name. I'm sure everyone here has heard it too many times in the past 2 weeks. I will say, though, that I don't believe he was really an ISIS operative. Based on what has come out in the FBI's investigation so far, I think he was probably a deeply closeted gay man who had heard all his life, especially from his father, that being gay was evil. He internalized that hatred and could no longer live with it. He had attempted to pick up men at the Pulse nightclub several times, but apparently was always rejected. Had someone accepted his advances, would that person have become an individual victim of this man's rage and self-loathing? I doubt that we'll ever know. But we do know that early on the morning of June 12th, he went to the Pulse nightclub and started shooting everyone in sight with a semi-automatic weapon designed for the purpose of killing many people quickly. He did what he could to wipe out a large group of people who represented the thing he could never dare to be, his real self. 49 lives lost and more than 50 wounded because the shooter could not allow himself to see the inherent worth and dignity of happy LGBT folks and their allies having fun at a nightclub. More than 100 families shattered by his need to see them as an unholy other. That is the somber reality of the aftermath of Orlando and of so many other tragedies caused by someone going to the dark side. As Unitarian Universalists, we can have several reactions. We can provide help to those directly affected. We can offer our time, money, or other aid to groups that support organizations that help the victims, as well as groups that work to prevent similar tragedies. On an individual level, we can strive in our daily lives to let the first principle shape our behavior towards others. As noted in our opening words, we can treat people with respect and dignity while questioning, challenging, or even confronting their behavior. Yes, doing so is difficult. I think our UU faith is about calling us to our better selves, and I don't think that's supposed to be easy. That's it. Thank you.
So we now have plenty of time, yes, which is a good thing for this topic, for questions and comments, and Mary will be carrying the microphones.
And I would say right now I have no answers, so.
But you can still make comments.
I'll make comments, yes. I'll reply to your comments. There must be somebody who has a comment. Okay.
Well, I guess I don't have answers either. This is my comment is sort of more questions than answers. But I guess one of the things I think about is I have this reaction that there are sort of at least two questions that come to my mind. And one is for people who sort of are motivated to work against fear, how do we do that? Because I think that there's a lot of psychological research that shows that at least to some degree, fear of the other is kind of a natural thing. And we kind of, we being everybody have to kind of struggle against that. But then the second question is, what about the people who really are not motivated to even attempt that struggle, which I kind of fear is a growing and or bigger than I imagine slice of the population based on what's going on right now. Yeah. So anyhow, my thought was just that the...
I see your...
How do we sort of reach out to the people who aren't even, you know, seeing this as a worthwhile struggle?
I think it can be really hard to reach out to those people. I think that a lot of people are looking for what they consider to be easy answers, and they're looking for somebody to tell them what to do and how to think. And there are some candidates who, you know, fall into that category, and they're looking to those candidates to, quote, make everything better. Our form of government is not an easy. It's quite hard, and it requires a lot of work for people. And I think our best chance is to reach out to people who are kind of on the edge, who could sort of fall either way, and be good examples, you know, of how to behave. And this the reason I mentioned Jericho was and spent so much time on it was that it. It was to me, a scenario of something that could happen. People have been worried about a nuclear apocalypse, you know, off and on in the United States for 60 years, you know, more than 60 years. And, you know, it showed very ordinary people responding to extraordinary situations. And Jake, who, like I said, had been considered the black sheep, he turned out to be a leader, you know, and people would not have expected that of him. And I think that there are a lot of people that you don't expect to rise to the occasion, and yet, given the opportunity and given some encouragement, they will. So, like I said, I have no answers. So.
Well, I guess one of the things that sort of strikes me is that the more economic justice there is, I think the more people are open and less fearful they are.
Yeah.
The more scared they are economically.
Yes. And I think that you know, there some of the Brexit vote, I think there were people who were voting because they thought that, quote, immigrants were taking their jobs, and immigrants were not taking their jobs. Employers were giving jobs at lower pay to immigrants, people who were willing to work for lower pay, which is not taking your job. You know, it's really taking advantage of people who are not used to a higher standard of living, you know. So, Gary?
I want to speak on behalf of fear.
On behalf of fear, okay.
We tend to think it's a negative, and it is. It can often be prevent us from acting properly. But when you look at what's happening in the world, mass migrations of millions and millions of people, crowding into areas that they weren't in before, creating situations that weren't there before, climate change, threatening submerged islands, shorelines. Fear has a very real purpose in saying, hey, we gotta worry about this, we gotta figure out what we're gonna do about it. There can be short-sighted reactions to fear, but the fear is what would like to say, we've got to do something different. And it can be a very positive feeling that we have to look at it and say, how do we accommodate this? Because ultimately, if we keep going the way we're going, we won't survive.
Yeah. Well, you're highlighting that we have some very complicated problems we're not dealing with very well, climate change being one of the foremost. The refugee crisis is caused by an ongoing war that we can't seem to find a solution to currently. And, you know, I think that were we able to get some people together who could actually get that war stopped, you know, that would provide some stability. I mean, the Syrian people who are leaving are tired of being bombed. You know, they're just attempting to live. And unfortunately, this pushes them into Europe and other places where people feel you know, like there's, you know, quote, too many of them, unquote, coming over. And, you know, I understand what you mean, though, about fear being, you know, fear is good if it enables you to move in a positive direction. But if it only pushes you towards doing negative things, then, you know, you have to think about it. You have to really be able to think about what your reaction is. And unfortunately, a lot of people just kind of react blindly. So, next. Oh, Randy.
My comment about fear. Fear is real. I agree. But I think what we forget is how we respond to that. And we're scared of ISIS, but we don't bomb them out of existence to solve the problem. It perpetuates. You do it over and over again. And that's the problem. It's how we do it. And we're smart enough people. We can figure out alternative ways. But we don't know any more of those ways at all.
Jim. Yeah.
So you're saying you like, is it fantasy?
It's not all fantasy. Some of it's fantasy, and yeah, you know, just.
I would say we are in an apocalypse right now.
Well, yeah.
a zombie apocalypse, actually. It's the mindless, our culture is very mindless in how we act and we respond. The sides, the winnings, the reality TV kind of thing, it's always picking a side. It's the casino capitalism of one day I'm going to hit it and I'm entitled to be rich. Mm-hmm. And it's everybody else that's keeping me back. I'm going to get it. And we always want winners. And I think that mentality is what is, you know, and probably a lot of it is fear or whatever, but that's where we're at. We have these world views that just get reinforced every day. Mm-hmm. And if you're picking one candidate, you could be faced with 1,000 facts why you should not support somebody. And you have one thing in your mind that's just completely not true, but that's what you cling to. So how you overcome that, I don't know. Yeah. When you treat people, you have to, this person is a complete moron, I can't say it though, but I have to treat them with kindness. I have to, you know, and that's, it's extremely hard, because I mean, we all face that every day. And, you know, like you said, I probably do every day, fail many times in that challenge, but you know, particularly at work, I try to make a conscious effort. Oh my God, this person! How am I going to deal with them? I'll just flood them with kindness, and usually you get good results. So it's a challenge, but we all have to do it. And not a lot of us know we need to.
Yeah, but when it comes to politics, I'm of the belief that facts don't matter to most people. That most people. For most people, they vote based on their values, and their values have to do with kind of more with their limbic system than with anything else. And if they tend to be oriented towards fear and aggression and things like that, they will vote one way. And if they tend to be oriented towards kindness and openness and willingness to see many points of view, they'll vote a different way. And so there are some people who, well, we know who that candidate is. I won't mention that person's name, but you know, that person said, I could shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue and not lose any votes. And I believe that is probably true of the people who are committed to that person, that they don't care what that person does. It doesn't matter. That person could throw the Pope off the roof of, you know, the Empire State Building, and they wouldn't care. Because that person talks about the things that they want to hear. So, somebody else?
So, add a little moment of humor I had on my desk at work for 40 plus years. I said, this is not real life, this is just a test. But in real life, somebody would have given some direction.
Okay. Ruth?
There's a fascinating book called Shantung Compound by a young man, Langdon Gilkey, who was a theological student in China and eventually became a Unitarian minister. And it's set in China during World War II, written by him. It's his account of what happened to him. It's It's in a Japanese prison camp, and it deals with the behavior of people under these extreme situations. There's not enough food, so they decide that they cannot serve baked potatoes, because baked potatoes come in different sizes. So they have to each have a quarter of a cup of potatoes. And a crisis comes when packages from the United States come from the Red Cross, and it turns out that there would be enough for everybody in the camp, but there are various people. There are the Trappist monks, there are Russians, there are people of various missionaries who have been in China and so on. And the American fundamentalist preachers caucus, and they make a decision, they're going to appeal to the Japanese, that all of these boxes of things that they haven't had for many, many years should go to Americans, because it's coming from the American Well, and that would mean that everyone would get, all the Americans would get free packages. Well, it turns out the Japanese decide to give everyone one package and send the rest down to another prison camp.
Ah.
And anyway, it's fascinating.
Wow, thank you.
Eileen.
I think they fancy their hands in the
back. Give everybody a chance, but before giving a person a second chance.
And I really appreciate your comments, and I do think that one of the things that's really that if you want to work to change, I appreciate what you said, Jim, in terms of talking one-on-one with other people. Mm-hmm. I think that we live in a time where people, and I've seen this reported, people tend to be with other people that are like themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it gets easier to dehumanize other people so that others, whatever the other is, whether mm-hmm. it's racial or whether it's sexual orientation or whatever, if people don't have personal connections with people who are somewhat different from themselves, including political differences, I think it's very hard to make those bridges.
Mm-hmm.
And I think relying on just the media has become mm-hmm. important to too many people, rather than people talking with each other. Growing up in a small town, I know that my parents had difficulty with people who had different outlooks than them, mm-hmm. but there was always dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I thank you, Eileen, for that. In my work with PFLAG, you knew I'd get around to that eventually. One of the things that we do is education as well as support, and I know a lot of people online who are allies to the LGBT community, and we all have the kind of the idea of each one teach one, that, you know, a lot of people believe they don't know somebody who is you know, lesbian or gay or bi or trans, especially transgender. And you know, the whole business with the bathroom bills that has gone on, which is very dehumanizing for trans people, you know, to be singled out that way. A lot of people believe they've never met a trans person. So especially if they meet a transgender child, you know, who, you know, started talking when they were 2 years old of, I'm not a boy, I'm a girl. You know, well, obviously their parents didn't tell them to do that. They didn't get that from the media. But I think that when people have the opportunity to meet somebody and talk with them and find out who they really are, then it can change hearts, you know. So who else is it? Ken? Yeah.
Catherine Kramer here at the university has written a very interesting book called Politics of Resentment, which I expect many of you know about. It's about, she interviewed many people in rural Wisconsin, and I heard her speak, and she describes stories about how people in rural areas kind of feel disconnected and unfairly treated in comparison to specifically Madison and Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
So to them, we're part of this problem of very large communities that really don't care about their circumstances in rural Wisconsin. So I guess I see kind of two approaches to it. For some reason, I don't find the fear is a useful way to think about what these people are experiencing. I think it's a resentment of unfairness. Mm-hmm. And I guess I see a real dichotomy in the political campaigns. There's one campaign which I think has been directly addressing that unfairness, trying to redress those grievances, a lot of social justice issues, economic justice issues, addressing those. And there's one that just seems to fan the flames of resentment. So it's really different political ways of approaching this resentment, which is it's something I don't see. Something I talk about fear seems to blame the people who have the fear, it strikes me that way.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I think, like we said before, I think fear is frequently a very natural reaction, and as for people voting against their best interests, the saying that I've heard is that everyone in America believes that they're not poor; they're just a temporarily disadvantaged future millionaire. So, anybody else? Kent, one more. Okay.
So I guess I'm sort of saying this in response to what Gary said about fear. And I think one thing is that we spend a lot of time being afraid of the wrong things, you might say. And there was a really interesting book I read, and I can't remember the author, unfortunately, about sort of security. And he basically said, you shouldn't worry about anything you hear on the news, because by definition, something on the news is kind of unusual. And his thing is, you hear about plane crashes on the news, you don't hear about car crashes on the news. Way more people get killed in car crashes. Or your chance of getting killed by ISIS terrorists is like a lot of your chance of getting struck by lightning or something. So I think part of the media is contributing to us worrying about ISIS, but not so much worrying about global warming or something like that, and kind of producing this knee-jerk reaction to things that are
Less important. That's there's a whole line of inquiry, I guess, and a whole management area called risk assessment, and I have a friend, a former coworker at DNR, who did a lot of that in the 90s, and he says, he told me that, people tend to worry about things that that seem bigger than they are, and that seem and that are close to them. That's why you have the not in my backyard stuff, with different environmental things, whereas something like climate change seems far away. Seems like it's not going to happen anytime soon, and that it's harder to envision. It's harder to put your hands around or whatever. So.
Okay, so I still have the mic, so I want.
All right. Okay. Good. One more.
My uncle had a really good way of starting a conversation when someone said something that he didn't agree with, and that he wanted to engage that person in conversation with. He said, well, I can't agree with you. And then that started the conversation rather than starting in with, castigating that person for having that opinion. He said, I can't agree with you. And then it would start a conversation.
So thank you, Anne.
All right. Back down here.
So we now have the opportunity to contribute our financial resources as well as our cognitive resources, which we did a moment ago. And today we will be dividing our offertory, as we have this month, with Madison Urban Ministry. And there's a little description of that in your order of service. And Mary will be playing for us. Thank you. Thank you.
I don't know how other soloists feel. I really don't want the applause.
Okay, all right.
Well, no, I'm glad you appreciate it, but music.
Don't applaud from here.
So now is the time for welcoming any guests or visitors. If you're here for the first or second time, or maybe you haven't attended for a while, we invite you, if you choose to, there's no coercion, to just introduce yourself and say for a moment what brought you here. It just helps for us to get to know you so we can talk with you a little bit after service. Is there anyone who'd like to? And please wait for the microphone.
My name is Jennifer Keene. This is my first time here. My husband and I just moved from Central Missouri at the end of this month. I was part of a UU congregation in my old town, so I wanted to see if I could find us a little fellowship.
Well, thanks so much for coming. Okay, then please join us for our final hymn. It's number 318, We Would Be One, and stand as you are able. Closing words? Are you doing those today, Rick?
I am.
I know this is one of those where we had more than one volunteer, so go for it.
We have a calling in this world. We're called to honor diversity, to respect differences with dignity, and to challenge those who would forbid it. We are people of a wide path. Let us be wide in affection and go our way in peace. Amen. Jean Rickard.
Please greet your neighbor and join us for coffee and conversation. And thank you so much for coming.